Good morning, and thank you for joining us on another episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. I am your host, Sharifa Hardy, and I have a very interesting show for you today. As always, we're going to learn, we're going to laugh, and we're going to enjoy this time together. Go ahead and share the show because friends don't let friends miss out on the Roundtable Talk Show. Our first guest is Lisa Gable, and Lisa Gable is going to talk to us about her business, Fair. She also is a former U.S. ambassador, and she is a presidential advisor. Good morning, Lisa. How are you?
Good morning. Great to see you this morning.
You are welcome. It's great to see you. You look wonderful. I love your background. Tell us a little bit about FAIR.
Sure. FAIR, it stands for Food Allergy Research and Education. We are the largest medical research organization and funder of research around life-threatening food allergies, which is essentially 32 million people in the United States who carry epinephrine auto-injectors because if they accidentally eat a food, they can go into anaphylaxis.
I know that sometimes people feel that that's no big deal, that you have a food allergy, it's nothing, you may get a little rash, maybe you get a little cough, but I don't think people take it as serious as they should. That's just my opinion. What are your thoughts?
I absolutely agree. And that's one of the reasons I love being on shows like this. So I really appreciate your inviting us today. Really, with a life-threatening food allergy, it's not a food sensitivity, it's not a food intolerance. And we fully respect people who might have upset stomachs or other types of conditions, which can be very painful. In our case, what happens is anaphylaxis means that two systems shut down. So essentially, that might be that your throat closes up and your blood pressure drops. And so when someone goes into anaphylaxis, they need to immediately take an epinephrine auto injector, take the shot, call 911. And get immediately into the emergency room because it is life-threatening and people die. And the very sad thing is that we've had a number of children who have passed away because people didn't understand how the type of food that they had may have something in it that the child was allergic to because it went by a different name. Maybe they didn't read the label correctly, or maybe the school didn't know how to provide emergency care.
I saw an article, and I honestly wish I would have paid more attention to this article based on just having you here today. But it was an article about a young man who had a food sensitivity or food allergy, and he went to have a birthday cake prepared. And when they prepared the birthday cake, they specifically told them he cannot have this, do not add it, please. And they put it in there, and then they had a verbal conversation about his food allergy. Turns out the bakery created the cake with this same item, and unfortunately, the young man passed away. But his parent started this kind of movement to inform more people about the importance of really paying attention to food allergies and not, because I think we tend to say, oh, they'll be okay. He'll be all right. Little things will happen, but he'll live. And with food allergies, that is not always the case.
No, it's not. And one of the saddest stories is the story of a little boy named Elijah. Elijah was 3 years old, going to school in New York City. And the preschool teacher did not think about the fact that Elijah was allergic to dairy, and someone gave him a cheese sandwich. And Elijah passed away. And his parents are amazing, amazing people of faith. They are both incredibly talented. His mother was a gospel singer. She also performs, and she's written beautiful music about how to survive after something so horrific happens. And the families really come together and is so respected by everybody in the food allergy community as they pass something called Elijah's Law to make sure that never happens again. The dad, Thomas, is out speaking to governors, ensuring that schools, and especially preschools and preschool situations, childcare, are aware that you really need to understand that these are nine proteins and they're in a lot of the food that we eat, even goldfish. People don't realize that there's dairy in goldfish. And so at a church, I know we have Pastor Bob here, and I know that in my church, it was always the goldfish that you gave to the kids during Sunday school. Goldfish can actually cause anaphylaxis for kids with certain types of allergies.
Yes, I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest. Pastor Bob Haight, who is here with us today. And not
Yes.
only are you a pastor, but you're a community developer as well. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Sharifa, and good morning to you as well, Lisa. Thank you, Sharifa, for the opportunity to be with you this morning. It's a delight to meet you and great to be on your show this morning.
You are so welcome. I know I'm kind of casual today, but I actually dressed in your honor today, Bob. I put on my blessed shirt. I said, I'm going to have the pastor on the show, and I wanted him to know that I am blessed. I didn't see one with and highly favored, and that probably would have like went below, but I am blessed and highly favored, and I'm just honored to have the opportunity. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Bob, and what you
Yeah, no, thank you. And you are blessed and highly favored. You as
do.
well, Lisa. So you can go get the t-shirt as well, Lisa. Yeah,
Okay.
thank you. Basically what we do, what I started about 17 years ago was a separate nonprofit alongside the church that would have a specific emphasis to what I refer to as life outside the four walls of the church, which is where people in my faith context as followers of Jesus, that's where we're called and that's where we're kind of supposed to live anyway, is outside the four walls. And so we wanted to really focus our attention on the needs of the community around us. And so I started a separate nonprofit, a community development corporation called LifeBridge Community Alliance. And basically what we do, we come alongside the working poor and we work to provide programs and services that will enable them to become less dependent on social services and programs so that they can lead more independent lives. We like to say that we work to build strong people, strong families, and strong communities. And we define strength to mean independent living, less dependent on social services and programs.
I want to go back to the first one of the first things that you said, life outside the four walls of the church. I have seen during this global pandemic many industries who are struggling to maintain or to operate or stay open and keep their doors open. I believe, and it's just my humble opinion, that churches have been one of the worst hit because people feel like they have to go to church. I think more and more pastors, preachers are having online services, but they still had people within the church. What have you found has been the most difficult aspect of being forced to have church outside of the four walls?
Well, that's really an interesting question and some great observations on your part. And we kind of we're I think this is an opportunity for the church to redefine herself. And by that, I mean, in many ways, simply return to our roots, return to what we really were all about anyway. So rather than having the ch people come to church, the church really is called to go to people. And so I understand that, weekly gatherings or Bible studies and worship gatherings and prayer gatherings, those are very much a part of our culture and a part of who we are and who we're called to be and what we're called to provide. But at the same time, part of our focus is to decentralize the work and the ministry of the church, which is to make it more possible for people to participate in these kinds of activities, very important spiritual development activities and exercises by going to them. So going into homes, that's not really a bad place. In fact, it's in homes that the early church, first, second, third century church, started and thrived. So not really a bad thing. I know it's difficult and it's challenging because as church leaders and faith-based folk, we're used to a certain way of doing things, and our people are used to doing those same kinds of things. But we're actually seeing some, very interesting signs of life, new signs of life, new kinds of energy within the church, and real blessing among our people as they're actually more engaged in the life of the church because the church is happening a little closer to them. It's become a little more personal. It's in their home, or it's among the people that they are a part of. And in Arizona, we've actually been able to regather. Maybe a little bit sooner than other places around the country. So some of our people have been meeting homes now for several weeks and doing some of the activities that I just described.
Arizona. Yes, probably because of the weather. Because one of the things with the hot weather, they say it's better for you for a lot of different reasons. One of the things that I've seen personally is there's a church directly across the street from me. And it was interesting. I've been here, living here for 3 years. And before moving here, I would always say, I only go to church for for some people's weddings and some people's funerals. Not everyone's wedding and not everyone's funeral. Sure. You know, I'm a believer, but I have never felt that you have to go to a particular building in order to be religious. Then 3 years ago, I got this house that I just love, and it's directly across the street from the church. So every Sunday morning, the pastor opens wide the church doors, and I tell him, I hear every amen. I hear every word, every hallelujah. I said, so someone somewhere was like, oh, Sharifa's not going to go to church. We going to bring the church to Sharifa.
That's great. I love it. Thanks for sharing that story.
It is true. I don't want to leave you out, Lisa. I want to go back to what you were talking about because it's very important. What are some of the things that you're seeing right now during this global pandemic? Because a lot of kids aren't at school, they're at home. Has this been better for them, worse for them? Because I know one of the things parents, you know, maybe they're working from home, but they're not, you know, working with the children. What have you seen?
Yeah, what we've seen is it's interesting. Food allergy children avoid so many foods because they're never quite sure of the source that number of their parents are saying now that the child is home, they're actually gaining weight. There's some kids who will be severely underweight because mom controls the food, right? Like when mom's giving you the food, we know that she's making sure that's food that's not going to cause you to be ill. When you're accepting food from a stranger in a restaurant, there's always a concern and you ask the questions, but nothing's as reliable as mom. And so we've actually seen the overall health improve of these children. But at the same time, these children live with a high degree of anxiety. And I think the biggest concern and anxiety that is out there for all parents is, you know, how are they going to emerge? How are they going to emerge as a family? And with the cancellation of summer camps and different childcare centers, again, food allergy families have found those camps that they know are safe for their kids, or they found that situation in childcare that they know that they understand their children's needs, or maybe they're driving and getting their favorite takeout. And all of a sudden you're venturing back into the world, a world of great uncertainty for COVID, but also more uncertainty because those resources that you relied on, they may not have survived the economic shutdown. And so you may be having to go to new resources. The other thing that we find, and this is the hardest thing for our families, is that they have to avoid so many foods that when they're ordering their food and they go and they you know, you drive to Martin's or you drive to Kroger's and you sit in the parking lot, you know, you call them and they open your trunk and they put your food in, half the food they ordered's not there. Well, for someone who doesn't have a food allergy, you're okay with the substitution. But if you have a food allergy, you may not, like all of a sudden, the amount of food you had to feed your family that week just went down to this. And so we're hearing really just heartbreaking stories of people who can't find food substitutes. And they are looking for something that the substitutes end up being very, very highly priced, their proteins. And so when you think that they're already highly priced because maybe it's an alternative to peanut butter, an alternative to dairy, those are premium priced products. Well, if that's all your child can eat because they have six food allergies or five food allergies or a dairy allergy, and they can't get that thing, then all of a sudden they're having to shop at lots of different places, more exposure, they're having to pay much higher prices, and they've lost their jobs. I mean, this is a combination. When people talk about the public health impact of COVID, I'm not sure people are recognizing the public health impact of people who actually have other diseases besides COVID. And so access, affordability, opportunity, if they're reliant upon a food bank, and we're seeing those numbers go up daily as people are losing their jobs and people aren't able to go back to work. Think about if you have a food allergy and you show up at the food bank and there's nothing there your family can eat, because what do we take to food banks? We take canned tuna fish. Fish can be a life-threatening allergy for someone. We take peanut butter. Peanut butter is a cost-effective thing. Well, let's take extra peanut butter to the food bank. If you can't eat peanut butter, what do you get at the food bank? So it's been a very strong economic strain for the underserved community. And it's been a strain even for people who may be had the financial resources, because they have to go to so many places to find something that their child can eat.
Now, Lisa, I'm going to ask you up front to just forgive me. I want you to forgive my ignorance, because this is not a topic that I'm very familiar with. But I also tell people that I do my shows sometimes for very selfish reasons. And that's for me to learn about a lot of different things, so I am more informed. One of the things that you mentioned is that a person or a child may have a lot of different food allergies. What I have kind of thought in the past was that maybe they just have one. That person is, like you said, allergic to peanut butter, or maybe they're allergic to dairy. I have, like, my cousin, she's allergic to fish. She can't eat any type of fish. My nephew, I don't know exactly what it is, but he can't even go inside like a Red Lobster. If he does, he doesn't have to eat the food. He just smells it, and he just breaks out all over. His eyes get red, and he can't go anywhere near seafood. But what are some of the type of allergies? That's the first thing. But secondly, do people tend to have, like, if they have one, then they'll have five or six? Or is it more, do most people just have one allergy?
So we know there are 32 million Americans with life-threatening food allergies. And actually, FAIR is starting a data commons center. We've got a patient registry so we can collect more data on the numbers that exist within that 32 million. However, what we also know is that peanuts are 25% of people with life-threatening food allergies do have a peanut allergy. Many people who have a peanut allergy have what we call tree nut allergy. So that's your walnuts, your almonds. You know, if you think through every type of tree nut, pistachios. We know that many children, we don't have the exact number, but we know of many children who have multiple food allergies. There is someone in the U.S. Congress whose child has 22 food allergies. Could you imagine avoiding 22 foods? I have a board member whose child could only eat 15 foods. And in fact, I was talking to the, and you know, it's a board member, right? So we will assume that they're individuals with financial means. The entire family stuck eating the same 15 foods during COVID because they're all eating his diet, and because there's that concern. We have board members whose kids have six of the eight. So when you ask what the food allergies are, I'm going to fully admit whenever I have to do it on the spot, I'm going to forget one. So food allergy moms, I do this every time. Normally I carry a list around with me. I should have it memorized. But you're basically talking about sesame, tree nut, peanut, wheat, not gluten, wheat, dairy, fin fish, which are any fish with a fin, shellfish, egg, and there is one more. See, I told you there's always one more that I'm going to forget on there. It's sesame. But you know, there, if you think about sesame, hummus, I eat hummus. It's something that when I'm really going busily and I don't have much time to eat, I'll like get a cup of hummus and I'll start eating it. Hummus has sesame in it. And so, you know, this is a concern, and it's hard. If you have a dairy allergy, if you think about how many things that dairy and egg are in, it's a lot. It's you know, this gets back to the goldfish conversation. Well, it's goldfished, right? So what else is in it? And so our families spend an inordinate amount of time reading the labels, and they're really loyal customers. But like I said, during real life, they sometimes have to visit multiple stores in order to put together an affordable meal package for their family for the week. During COVID, it's off the charts in how difficult it is for people who are trying to manage what's already a very, very complex diet. We did something called the top nine swaps. Last week was Food Allergy Awareness Week. And so we asked everybody on one day to make a meal where they didn't use any of the allergens. I managed to get dinner there, and I was calling different people to make sure I wasn't screwing up, that I hadn't included anything I didn't know about. Dinner was tough. My lunch, I managed to get 7 out of the 9 not in my lunch. Because I looked through my pantry, and with COVID, I couldn't come up with a 9 clear of all the allergens. So it is much more difficult than people realize.
I can imagine. I wouldn't even You know, I'm praying for all of the families, and I'm sure Pastor is praying for them as well, because this is something that I don't think people really understand is really affecting a lot of different people, a lot of different children. And one of the things that I learned from my nephew, and that's what I want you to expand on, he was never tested. Like, there wasn't any test on for allergies as a baby or as a small child. This is one of those things, at least with him, so that's why I want you to expand on it,
Yeah.
where they found out because he had a reaction. Are there tests? Are there things that you can do to find out early before something happens?
Well, that is a very good question. In fact, there are different types of blood tests and tests that they can do, which indicate that the child has an allergy. But what you can't test is severity. And so what you don't know is how severe that child's reaction is. There is this horrible test called the oral food challenge. And what the oral food challenge does is it takes a child, and maybe that child is 7 years old, and they've been told their entire life, don't eat that food, don't be near that food. If you touch that food, you can die. Be scared of that food. And then you sit them in a doctor's office, and you have to feed your child the thing you have told them could kill them until they have anaphylaxis. And that's how they test severity. And it's horrible. It's awful. One of my board members' child was brought back to life after six EpiPens during the oral food challenge. It is frightening. I mean, if you can think about the anxiety already that a child has, and then you're sitting there and your mom's saying, I know I've told you all these awful things, but now you have to eat the food. And so one of the biggest things FAIR is doing right now is that we are going to be funding, and we're raising money to fund what's called an alternative to the oral food challenge. Is there a way? Because also you have to stay there for so long, because they don't, because the reaction can happen. It can be a delayed reaction. It may not be instantaneous. You may have gotten through six pistachios, and it's the seventh one they give you that sends you into anaphylaxis. And so what the doctors are looking for, and what we're hoping we're going to be having a series of funding activities that we really want all the innovators who are listening to this to think about and participate in. And it will allow us to have a test that you could actually take the test, you send it to a lab, the child gets to go home, and then they find out what the severity of their food allergy is. If we can figure out in that 32 million, how many people are going to react at this level and how many people are going to react at that level, it would make it so much easier for doctors to think about therapies, for families to really understand what their risk is. Nobody should have to end up in the hospital as the proof that they were allergic to something.
Yes, I always just believe knowledge is power. You know, it would seem to me, because we test babies for a lot of different things. To me, it would just seem like certain tests that they could do, poke them in the foot, get some blood, you know, when they're in the hospital, at when they're born, and they can find out a lot about what's going on. So I hope and pray that that is done better. I want to move back over to you, Pastor. One of the things that you mentioned is one of the things that I have truly, truly, truly been passionate about. And that is the working poor. Most people want to sweep the working poor under the rug and pretend they don't exist. But you have a lot of families, you know, where they are working. They're working 40 hours. I saw a video about an adjunct professor who was teaching classes, but she was also receiving food stamps. She had to use food stamps in order to pay for her food. There was no assistance for her. So I want to you to talk a little bit more about what you're doing to help people in this situation.
Yeah, thank you. And Lisa, thanks for those incredible comments. Thank you for the education that you just provided for me. Just sitting here listening to you talk, very, very helpful. Like, for instance, in our emergency resource center, currently we're helping about 850 households a week, which would translate to
Wow.
about 3,500 people who are coming into our main resource center. We have two others, and then various other programs where we go out into neighborhoods. But in our resource center alone, right now, we do these drive-through grocery and household cleaning product events. So we'll have dual lanes of traffic lined up about 50 deep for two and a half, 3 hours. But one of the things that you helped me with is on that like sign-in list that they get as the vehicles are coming through, they get this little sign-in sheet that helps us get some information about how we can serve them. And it just occurred to me, we don't ask a very important question on that list. And you're nodding, you know where I'm going with this. We don't ask the question, do you have any food allergies? And I'm sitting here thinking, how did we miss that, you know, over the last many years? So thank you for the education, the insights that you provide there. You're going to help us make some improvements on our end. So Sharifa, thank you. A very good question that you've asked regarding the working poor. But before we get into some of the specifics of what we're doing, let me just mention this fact that many people maybe are not aware of. The working poor demographic group, if you will, in our country is the fastest growing demographic group in our country. And it has been for the last several years. This whole COVID pandemic has, you know, perhaps accelerated that. And I personally don't believe that we even know what the individual or family economic impact yet is going to be. I think we're still, you know, probably another 45 to 60 days away from that, really knowing what the full impact will be. And here's why, because many individuals and families applied for loan deferments. So car payments, mortgages, and banks and credit unions and lending institutions have been gracious enough to come alongside individuals and say, look, if you need to, you can defer your payments out 60, 90 days. And research that I've read indicates that about 30% of Americans have signed up for those loan deferment programs. Now, listen, there's a difference between a loan deferment and loan forgiveness, right? Loan forgiveness says, hey, it's all good, all right? You don't owe me anything. A loan deferment says there's going to be a point when you have to pay up. And most of those loan deferments payments are balloon payments that'll be due at the end of that 60 to 90 day period. My concern is when we get 60 to 90 days down the road, people, it's not that they're unwilling to pay their bills. They can't pay their bills. They've not been working. And so when you get to the end of that 60 to 90 day period, how will people be able to pay those loans? So I think the gap, you know, that exists here with the working poor between middle America or however you want to look at it, I think it could perhaps grow even wider. These are going to be some issues that I think the church needs to be prepared to lean into and lead into. That's our job. It's what we're called to do. It's not even our job. It's our privilege. It's our calling. It's more than a job. I didn't say that correctly. It's our calling. We're called to love others. That little placard, that picture there off to your left shoulder, Sharifa, reminds us of the importance of love for all of us, regardless of what our faith background is, as just being a part of humanity and participating on this planet with other people of various race and color and background and whatever. It really doesn't matter. We're really called to part of being a part of the human race. We're called to love and care for each other. And so I think it's something that we can, you know, we can begin to prepare for. How can I make a difference? How can I be a part of doing something that will help, you know, my neighbor? We just started another initiative out of not only a need, but out of an opportunity that we saw where we do these drive-through events and we've, you know, in targeted neighborhoods where we believe that people would have a difficult time coming to us. They're what we would refer to as transportation challenged. So we'll take huge truckloads of food and supplies into distressed neighborhoods and we'll distribute them in those neighborhoods. And oftentimes we will have so much that's come in, so much product that's come to us. We'll finish up a 3-hour event. We have to shut it down because of the heat out here in Phoenix. We'll shut it down and we'll bring it back to the resource center. We had an idea about 3 weeks ago. What if we decentralized even more and said to our people, look, come in and get enough supplies that we will supply for you, food and cleaning products and so forth. Take them back into your neighborhood and set up a miniature little resource center, if you will, in your driveway for an hour. Go knock on the doors of your neighbors, particularly those who are seniors or those who are maybe disabled or those who are transportation challenged. Knock on their door and see if they need anything. And so there's just these different ways that we can, I think, engage to help people. They don't have to be huge. A little bit of a lot makes a difference. And so I know I kind of was all over the map there, but you know, the emphasis.
I like all over the map. I mean, that's a good thing. I was following along. Were you following along, Lisa?
I was. It was good.
Well, you know, the emphasis on the working poor, I think this is an important time. And we in the church, we really need to get this. It's a phenomenal opportunity for us to sit down and think, okay, what are the needs in our community and where are the gaps? You know, Lisa, you used a very important word several minutes ago. You used the word accessibility. In your context, you used it with one application. I would use it as well. We start to think about the difficulties, the challenges, maybe the inconveniences to some regard with what this whole COVID-19 pandemic has brought into our lives. We need to understand that with the working poor and with some people groups, it's not an inconvenience. Like, it's life threatening. Okay, so we talk about, for instance, an example, we talk about the way out of poverty for people in many ways includes a very important element called education. Well, here's what we've had to do across America. We've had to pull kids out of an educational process and move them into their homes. We can make certain assumptions with that all children and families are able to make that jump. They have the tools, they have the equipment, they have the environment around them that's conducive to learning. That's not the case in many cases, unfortunately. So we're dealing with mass numbers of children and families who don't have computers, they don't have internet access, and they don't have a safe, comfortable learning environment where they can continue their education. If you shut a child off of education, you remove from them the opportunity to get out of poverty and to break that cycle of poverty. These are the things that in the church, I think we have the opportunity, not just to participate in, but to really lean into and lead through those things. That's what being the church, I think, is all about in so many different ways. Not just the spiritual focus, that's important. I'm not minimizing that. Please don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that we should ignore the spiritual aspects of who we are and what we do. But even, you know, you read through the Gospels, Jesus was very interested in meeting physical needs of people, meeting their emotional needs. He didn't separate spiritual from emotional, physical, or mental. It was all in the same context for him. When you come alongside someone and you help someone, when you love someone, it touches into all of those very important parts of a person's being.
That was great. I was getting a little misty-eyed listening to you talk. You were tapping into that emotion where I was just like, you know what? That is, you can, you know, no matter what, you can tell a person's spirit, no matter what they call themselves, whether they're a pastor, a mom, you know, priest, whatever it is, you can feel truth resonates with you. Maybe that's just me. And so I felt your sincerity in what you were saying. One of the things that you mentioned, Bob, was that you were going out into the community. One of the things that I've noticed is that maybe the pastors aren't going out into the community. And during this time, they are having trouble reaching their congregation, because maybe they haven't set technology up in place. Maybe there's no newsletter for the church. How, aside from just simply, you know, walking and going door to door, have you been reaching your congregation?
Well, yeah, I mean, those are very real challenges that you just mentioned. And so I don't want to be dismissive of those. But I also think that, you know, at the core of who we are and what we're called to do, it's really not that complicated. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can find ways. You can go back into times in church history. You can look around the world where, you know, you can see, you don't see all the tools and the technology and all those things. Not that they don't help us and not that we shouldn't, you know, fully utilize what is available to us, but I don't think we should use as an excuse, well, I don't have those things, therefore I can't do this. Mm-hmm. I think we can find ways to reach out to people. We can find ways to let people know we're here. And I think we need to start with an understanding of the power of a little. In our culture today, we tend to measure our success and effectiveness by size, by numbers, by, you know, all those kinds of metrics. I think we miss the value oftentimes of, you know, just what seems to be small to us. To Jesus, what was big was each individual, the person who was in front of them in that moment, whether it be a child, whether it be a diseased woman who he was socially not even supposed to be around or to recognize, or certainly not to touch in any way. He noticed, he was aware of the one individual, that one small person or thing in front of him, and he elevated it. And so I think in the church, we can do that. We can look and say, look, you know, maybe I'm not reaching thousands of people or hundreds of people. The bottom line is we came alongside one human being, and that's not small. That's powerful. It's beautiful. That's the way the kingdom of God is designed to be advanced, to move forward here on earth.
That was a beautiful answer. I think I wasn't specific in my question, so I'm gonna rephrase it a little bit. You know, because I think no, it was beautiful.
I just go off on these tangents.
No, but I think because, you know, I'm not the best at asking questions because I don't know specifically, you know, a lot of these different things. Like, you both are throwing me. I usually don't discuss religion or food allergies. Give me something I know, like market
politics.
Yeah, politics. Give me something I can have a voice on. But
you
don't
have to discuss religion with me. This is life, and spirituality is a part of life. So it's perfectly fine. I'm comfortable talking with you.
Good answer. But I think the question you answered was more specifically towards finding new members. The question that I asked was specifically targeted to people within the church. You know, maybe it's a church who had 100 members. Now, because of COVID-19, you know, the members aren't coming to them. Have you seen an increase in maybe just simply getting on the phone to say, hey, Bob, you know, we can't have church today, but let me talk to you for a minute. Do you need a word? Do you need, you know, that was specifically what I was asking.
Yeah, so you're talking about the care that we're able to provide for those who call, in our case, Pure Heart Church, right? Is that what you mean?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, no, those are important issues too. So I'm not saying that we sacrifice, you know, our focus on one group for the other. So the care of the people who call this place, if you will, their church family and church home is very important as well. So we do have we're able to have a strong online presence. So people can get on our website at pureheart.org and they can view all of our live streaming services and groups. We have online groups provided. We have a very strong recovery and support group emphasis as well. That's a whole nother unique set of dynamics and challenges, because those folks tend to really need, you know, face-to-face contact. But, you know, we've been able to provide something instead of, you know, not having anything that they can connect to. So our online presence has been helpful in that sort of group context, if you will. We're getting ready to make our second wave, if you will, of phone calls. So, you know, we're calling all of our 5,000 members, if you will, by phone and just checking in with them, seeing, hey, how are you doing? Is there anything we can help you with? That kind of thing. So I think those are the two primary ways that we've been able to connect. Now, recently here in Arizona, we've been able to regather into smaller groups with social distancing considerations and proper sanitization considerations and things like that. So we have been able to call people back a little bit.
That, again, was an excellent answer. Lisa, I want to ask you basically the same question.
Yeah.
One of the things that you mentioned, if I heard you correctly, was some parents have their children in specific schools or specific daycares or specific people who are very familiar with their children's food allergies. But when COVID-19 happened, maybe they didn't have access to those facilities. Did you see an increase in a need to communicate with those parents? How did you reach out to them? Because I know they may have said, okay, this is closed. Now, what can I do?
Well, we actually have a section on our website called foodallergy.org, which has a COVID-19 information on it. So it's not only related to things as they're anticipating, how did they move their children back out of the home? Because right now, so many people still are stuck with their children in the home. I mean, the reopenings haven't advanced into childcare. But so if someone goes to foodallergy.org and they see this banner that says, go here for COVID information, that's where it lives. And one of the big things we're working on right now related to that is that the CDC has issued its guidelines. And one of the suggested guidelines was moving children, closing down the cafeterias, closing down the playgrounds and moving children into the classroom for food. Mm-hmm. And so they haven't gone back to school yet, but our biggest fear right now is if schools begin, food allergy parents fought long and hard to move food out of the classroom. It's more dangerous in the classroom. It's highly condensed, higher degrees of residue, higher propensity for cross-contamination. By moving them all back into that small area, that's a problem. And so one of the things we're telling our families, and we're talking to the CDC about it, and we've actually just sent off letters to all the governors, and we're getting families to send letters to the governors and to their school administrators and contacting their school, is the question is, when we go back to school, we have what's called a 504 plan. Food allergies is considered a disability. So if we have a 504 plan, it has on there things that the school needs to do to accommodate. And it's not accommodate from a, oh, well, you have to do something special for me that you don't do for other people. It's, this is what you have to do to make sure that my child is safe. That's what a 504 plan is. And I think the word accommodation messes it up for some Americans. These are people with real disabilities who have physical endangerment from an action that could happen. And so we're really telling families to reach out and self-advocate and make sure that the teacher is aware. There are two kids in every classroom. If there are two kids in every classroom, I know of classrooms in Connecticut, it's almost 50% of the classroom have food allergies. Well, there are other schools in Lynchburg, Virginia, where I grew up, where I know of a school that's got 700 kids and only two kids have a food allergy. So it's very locally based, which is why programs like what Bob's talking about, when churches, communities, the local people come together, you know, it is interesting watching the reopenings, and I don't think people appreciate, I've lived all over the United States, I've worked all over the United States, how different things are on the ground. And so people like Bob take on an inordinate level of having to be involved, and people like our parents. You asked, and it was interesting, you were asking Bob about how do you stay in touch with people. I have written hundreds of personal letters to our advocates. I just send them a letter. I like try to do 100 a week, where I send a letter for the last 8 weeks and say, I know you're stuck at home. How are you doing? Send me a note if you need anything. We are setting up little virtual meetings where it'll be 10 people in a city that we used to go to frequently. And we have what are called support group leaders, and helping them move what used to be a physical interaction to help someone into a virtual interaction. So high touch is so critical during this time period. Everybody's suffering anxiety and stress. Everybody has a thing that's really critical to their safety and well-being. It's different for different people. It's different in different communities. So every organization, those of us that are on this, you know, stream today, as well as so many others, we have to be so hands-on, so in touch, really respond to people, make sure you answer their questions, make sure you give them information. Because when we do a webinar and there's all those chats going on, it's overwhelming, the variety of questions. And so we have to stay on top of that, and we have to highly personalize it, because it can't just be a big Zoom or a stream. It has to be personal. These are our people. We got to take care of them. And we know them, and we know that they each have very individualized needs. So that those are some of the things we're doing.
I love it. Mentioning support groups, I'm pretty sure you have some type of support group for the children. I know, because if being a child and having food allergies, they can suffer from, like you mentioned earlier, a lot of anxiety, because this has to be a child who, you know, children tend to go, I'll go over Bob's house, we'll go play, but maybe he can't go, you know, over someone's house, because you have to really be cautious of what you eat. You can't just eat anywhere. You can't just eat in anyone's house. Even before COVID-19, it has to give the child a sort of anxiety to kind of feel like they're living in this kind of glass box. What are some of the things that the parent can do to help children with that anxiety?
Sure. Well, one is that the support groups we have are for the moms, who then and then the kids get to know each other. And so we've had groups of families bond and do activities, whether they're walks or school fundraisers. And they're not activities to raise money. They're activities designed to get those children together. And one of the things that we also do is we gather families together. And that's the big question as to whether or not we'll be able to do that this year. Last year, we had 1,000 people, families and kids. And the ability of giving these children control of their lives is fundamental to us. So we have called the Teen Advisory Group. And the good news for us is they don't care if they're in person. They're happy to be on Zoom. They live on technology anyway. So these kids are really taking leadership positions in talking to other kids and thinking about things that can be done to support other kids. Because as you get older and you've gone through these questions, you rely on each other, and these children finding other people that are like them is really a critical part of how we try to integrate things. And when it's kid-led, it's always stronger. And these are pretty smart children, because at a young age, they were taught that they had to manage their life in a way that was incomprehensible. What's interesting about COVID is a lot of the things we're talking about that everyone else is now aware of, like hand washing, our kids were hand washing early on, right? They had to get rid of any residue, wiping down the seats of their airplanes. Yep, we were already there. So, and the anxiety that goes into what happens if I encounter something that's unhealthy for me, now the whole world's living it. So I actually think that there's probably going to be a higher understanding within the peer groups as to what it is that these kids live with on a daily basis, because now everyone's experiencing the same thing through COVID. Nobody has the answers. Nobody's quite sure. And the other element, we always used to say that food allergies was the only disease where an action taken by every individual could save someone's life, whether it was administering epinephrine, whether it was making sure that you didn't give somebody the wrong food, whether it was wiping up after you ate the food. Well, guess what? COVID's probably the first one out there that's similar, which is every action we take as individuals can save someone's life. And having that become embedded and developing that empathy and that awareness will actually relieve anxiety. And I think it's going to be beneficial to our kids in the long run.
One of the things that you mentioned was wiping down the seats on an airplane or wiping up after the kids. Like, that's new to me. So it's not just what they ingest. It may also be something that they touch, or is it just because they touch it and they put it in their mouths?
That's the big question. There are things like dairy allergies and peanut where there is an element that the skin is a barrier, and if the skin is breached, let's say the child has eczema or something, they could have a higher risk. A lot of children with food allergies also have asthma. They have asthma and eczema. They're called comorbidities, which are diseases that you find with immunology, you'll find that somebody who has an autoimmune disease may have two autoimmune diseases. So it's a similar thing. Somebody who has asthma. So think about the peanut dust on the airplane. If you have asthma and you have a food allergy, we have a scientist who works for us. She has asthma, eczema, and food allergies. Well, she already was getting on the airplane with a face mask, wiping things down. Everything is a barrier. What you breathe, your nose, how you filter things, that's a barrier. Your skin's a barrier. If some tactile, if you touch dairy, that can cause problems for some children. So yes, wiping down the seats has been the life of the food allergy family. It's one reason why we've been begging airplanes to allow early access. One side benefit of the way the airplanes are currently cleaning the planes is it may actually be safer for our families.
Mm. That's very interesting. Bob, what are your thoughts on that?
That's kind of outside of my field of expertise, to be honest with you. So I agree with Lisa. She's the expert. She's the person I'm listening to, you know, to give guidance. And I just appreciate the fact that she's willing to do that. I mean, this is, you know, I'm sure I'm probably not really all that different from a lot of people, just not being aware or educated on, you know, the whole issue of not just allergies, but particularly life-threatening allergies. So I think it's probably very important for, you know, people like me who are, you know, interacting with the public in a lot of ways, and maybe even providing services that we do, you know, that we pay attention to these kinds of considerations and needs and give some thought to them. So again, I thank Lisa earlier, but thank you, Lisa, for the education to not only just all the people who are tuned in, Sharifa, to you today, but to me, thank you. It's good stuff.
Yes.
Write a book.
Well, it's just, you know, I just have to say, though, listening to what you've talked about with your ministry, in return, knowing that there are people on the ground who really understand the needs of your community, and listening to you talk about how people are lined up and how you're trying to track, you almost sound like Chick-fil-A. They do an amazing job tracking people as they go through the line. I'm thinking the church Chick-fil-A model here. It really comes down to people on the ground in their locality coming together, and doing what's important to protect the people in their community. We're communities. These are our people. We chose to live in these places. We may not know all of these people personally, but we can all take certain actions and understand the economics of the people, why some people are desirous to go out and get their businesses going. This is life and death for some people from a financial standpoint. You may have a small business owner who has a child with life-threatening food allergies or a wife with cancer. They need to be able to economically operate, but it's knowing those people. That's when you care about them. You know what their stories are. And so I just appreciate everything you're doing and knowing the stories of the people that you're serving.
Yeah, I think, you know, you raise an important point there, Lisa, as well. You know, I mean, rather it's easy for us to draw conclusions, make quick assumptions, you know, rather than take a few minutes to ask some questions and learn a person's story. Because everybody has a story, and that we're all acting out of that story. Like, we're responding and acting out of, you know, our story, who we are and what our specific needs or our background or experiences are, or what our challenges are. So again, you know, to take the opportunity to maybe learn a little bit more about the people that are in our neighborhoods, or the people that we work with, or the people that we serve, our customers, our clients, or whoever, to take just a little extra step, move toward them, and learn a little bit more about them helps us in a number of ways, particularly when it comes to, you know, how we might be able to have opportunities to care for people. It's good stuff.
It is. I think everything that I've heard today is very good stuff. I enjoy having each of you as a guest today. We are coming down the last few minutes of the show. And what I love to do at the end of every show is just allow my guests the opportunity to speak directly to everyone who's watching the show live, as well as everyone who's watching it in the archives. And just please let them know what you would like for them to take away from your appearance. And we're going to start with you, Lisa.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. And really, my message is, hopefully you've learned a little bit about the needs of the food allergy families, especially the children. Go to foodallergy.org and you can learn more about what you can do to keep other children safe and to keep our families safe and also adults safe. So we really appreciate the opportunity to give you a little information. And also, I want to say thank you. I want to say thank you to the police officers, the firemen, and the nurses who help us out every single day.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for being a guest today. I truly appreciate the information. And as you can see from, like, I show everybody, these are my notes, my show notes. So I was just scribbling away today, and most of it was just more about the allergies and how we can be of service. And that's what I like to do. Bob, what do you have for us?
Yeah, again, Sharifa, thank you for the opportunity today. I've enjoyed meeting you and talking to you and admire your work and what you're setting out to do. I think it's great when you can get people in some sort of context together, talking and sharing their story and sharing their thoughts and ideas in respectful manners, even when we disagree. I think that's a real challenge for us today, a civil discourse, you know, a platform where we can help people grow in that skill of being able to disagree in an honorable and respectful way. And I just appreciate your work. And so thank you for the opportunity to be here and share a little bit of our story. I think, you know, if I could be anything today to the people who are listening in, I would hope to be a voice of encouragement. You know, these are challenging days, to say the least. And for many people, there's a lot of anxiety. Lisa mentioned that earlier. Stress and anxiety is probably at an all-time high for many, many people. And I'd like to be a voice of encouragement into that. You know, the work that we do is designed to help people. We don't want to just, like, serve people's immediate needs. There are a lot of people who do a lot of different, very good and beautiful things all across our valley and all across the country, helping people with food insecurity and so forth and so on. But really behind what we do is the idea that we can help people just pay attention to the fact that God is very alive and active and present, and he's attentive to their needs. We want people to know that. So the stuff that we provide to help people doesn't just come from us. We think of us as the mailman, okay? We just deliver the goods. We didn't create it. We didn't write the letter. We didn't write the story. We're delivering it. So I would like to be a voice of encouragement that points people back to our God and just help them be reminded today that he is loving, he is kind, he's very attentive, and he's committed to providing for our every needs. And hopefully that will help reduce a little bit of the fear and stress level. He is alive, he is active, and he's committed to loving his people and providing for his people. And we are all his people.
Beautiful words to end on. I couldn't think of anything better, any better way to end the show. I think those, I agree wholeheartedly. We are all his people. I want to thank you both for being a guest today on the Roundtable Talk Show. I want to thank everyone who tuned in to watch the show live, as well as everyone who's watching in the archives. I greatly appreciate you. Please go ahead and share the show. And if you are interested in being a guest, please visit the website at asharifa.com. Until tomorrow, everyone have a safe and a blessed day. Bye now.
Bye.